Thank you. And now, Pastor Comparé.
Now, neither Cain's original empire nor Nimrod's affected the people of Israel. And therefore, I would say that neither of those identifications are likely to be the correct one, and that Egypt is probably number one of the series. That, of course, Daniel didn't have, because Egypt had passed its peak. You remember that, somewhere around 775 B.C., Egypt was overrun and conquered by Negroes from the south. And they held it for about 75 years. And in that time, Egypt became the mulatto country that it is today, and all of Egypt's greatness was past. It was merely kicked around by whatever military adventurer came along with something in the way of an army at his heels. It ceased to be of any consequence. And Daniel, you see, was writing in the mid-500s B.C. So it was 150 years after Egypt finally threw off the Negro yoke, but couldn't get rid of the Negro blood. So that's why Daniel didn't get it. Then Assyria. Well, again, the Assyrian Empire was overthrown and destroyed. Nineveh fell in 612 B.C. And remember, Daniel wasn't writing this until the mid-500s B.C. So the Assyrian Empire was out of the way when Daniel wrote. So Egypt is the first of these five that are already fallen when John was writing. Then Assyria. Then number three is Babylon. Number four is Medo-Persia. Number five is the empire of Alexander the Great. All those had come and gone. So as the angel said, there are seven kings, five are fallen, and one is, and that was Rome, which completes now the four that Daniel saw. So Daniel's vision in the first place was entirely a prophecy of the future as of his time. It covered no review of past history, and even his look into the future only brought him to the beginning of the Christian era. It didn't carry on beyond that. John now was taking up at the beginning of the Christian era, and he got the vision concerning everything from then on. Now, of this strange beast with the seven heads and the ten crowns, he said, I saw one of his heads, as it were, wounded unto death, and his deadly wound was healed. Now, you remember when we were studying the Roman Empire, we saw that it split into two, corresponding to the two iron legs of the image that Nebuchadnezzar saw in his vision. There was the old Western Roman Empire, whose capital most of the time remained at Rome. On the other hand, it was moved to Ravenna for part of that time. And it remained the administrative head, while its power lasted, of the Western Roman Empire. In other words, Gaul, Spain, various Italian territories, for a while their North African territory, and a little bit into the Balkans, what would correspond to modern Austria. Then the easterly portion of it, with its capital city never moving from Constantinople, took over the easterly portion of the Balkans, and of course Asia Minor, Syria, and Palestine, and of course before long had Egypt added to it. But the power of the western part was fading out. It had a series of defeats and conquests. The Israelite people, the Visigoths, captured and looted the city of Rome itself in 410 A.D. And then after a short time, they moved on out, crossed southern France and the Pyrenees and into Spain, where they established themselves. And they were not the only people living in Spain, but they were the dominant ruling people in Spain from then on until the Moorish conquest, about 711 A.D. Rome was again captured and looted by the Vandals in the year 455 A.D. And it was again conquered by the Ostrogoths in 493. But it really had reached the end of its power before the Ostrogoths came along. In 476 A.D., the German mercenary general, Odoacer, who was leader of the Roman troops, the Romans had degenerated to the point where this formerly great military nation, conquering the known world, could no longer defend itself. The only way they could hope to fight off their enemies was to hire German mercenaries to defend them. And finally, tired of the trifling interference of this dissolute and incompetent emperor, why, Odoacer deposed him from the throne, and historians and generals say that the Western Roman Empire came to its end then. So here was one head of these seven, wounded apparently to death. And yet, John is told, its deadly wound was healed. And of course, that consisted of the setting up of the so-called Holy Roman Empire when Charlemagne was crowned Emperor of the Romans in the year 800. The rise of the power of the papacy really began before the total extinction of the empire there. In 452, Pope Leo the Great, acting as intermediary, persuaded Attila the Hun to spare Rome for a huge ransom payment which the emperor had raised. And that is where the popes began showing an influence greater than the emperor. By the middle 700s, the popes really had a thoroughly firm grasp on the power over Rome. The empire, of course, had collapsed completely. It was a matter of ruling the city and the suburbs around it. Then, when Charlemagne came in and took over Italy, he was crowned Emperor of the Romans by Pope Leo III in the year 800 A.D. And he personally continued his rule till his death in 810. His own dynasty fizzled out under his descendants, see, Charlemagne, Carolus Magnus, Charles the Great. But the last two of his descendants were known as Charles the Bald and Charles the Fat, their only distinguishing characteristics. In 888 A.D., the dynasty fizzled out, and you had again a return to chaos, with all these little petty kinglets scrambling madly for power, each one of them utterly despotic and keeping things in the continual turmoil, a continuous fight of one petty kingdom trying to conquer another. So there was such anarchy that definitely, as John was told, they worshipped the beast, this powerful beast who ruled them with tyranny, but at least with firmness. They were always trying to get themselves rescued by turning to some more powerful petty king. In other words, whichever king in one of these wars was getting the worst of it and about to be conquered by one of his neighbors would look a little bit farther afield to call in some other slightly more powerful petty king to his aid. Well, nearly always, the only effect it had was that instead of being conquered and added to the realm of the first king he was fighting with, he was conquered by and added to the realm of the one he called in as his ally. But that's the conditions they had then. So finally, the Italians, in desperation, called on Otto the First, the King of Germany, to rescue them. At that time, the Hungarians were devastating Lombardy up in the north, and the Saracens, who had conquered and occupied and ruled Sicily, were invading and conquering southern Italy. So Otto with his German armies came in to the rescue, and he was crowned emperor by Pope John the XII. And from this time on, this Holy Roman Empire continued without a break in its at least paper existence. It was always ruled by a Germanic king, although for about the last century and a half or so of its existence, it was in the hands of the Habsburg family, who settled in Austria as their basic domain. But Austria, remember, was completely Germanic in its population. It was one of the Germanic kingdoms. Well, the Holy Roman Empire had no actual power from about 1648, although the title itself was formerly claimed by one of these kings each time, until it was formally abandoned in 1806. So the deadly wound was healed. And the people within the realm there worshipped the dragon, which gave power unto the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like unto the beast? Who is able to make war with him?" In other words, to be rescued from the constant warfare of their petty princelings, they set up this bigger tyranny because they said this is too big for any of the little local ambitious leaders to make war with. So the way it was described to John now back in the 90s AD worked out correctly. Well, that's the cynical view of it, which is actually a correct one if you want to credit it with what idealism may have been in the minds of some of them. You can say they had the dream of a united and Christian Europe, powerful enough to suppress all this scramble for power among these little petty princelings. And of course, in those days, for lack of any competition, when you say Christian, you meant Catholic, because the Reformation hadn't yet come along. But basically, it was the worship of plain, blunt power. The utter tyranny that went with it, the utterly dissolute character of the ruling class, they accepted as just part of the price of somebody with power enough to rule with an iron fist and put down the disorder. Now let's see what the angel continued to tell him. "The beast that thou sawest was and is not and shall ascend out of the bottomless pit and go into perdition." Now we've seen already these six out of the seven kings. Five fallen, the sixth Rome existed at that time. And then the angel said, is not yet come. Now something after the end of the sixth, or Roman head of this thing, constitutes the seventh head, the seventh empire. Now these churches that have been following the tradition that you have to blame everything, including the weather, on the Catholic Church, are trying to put the Catholic Church into the position of being now this seventh head. But of course, never at any time were the papal states more than a tiny little thing in central Italy, petty indeed among petty kingdoms. Then they have tried to say, well, it's a revival of the Roman Empire to come back and rule for 3.5 years. Do you remember when Mussolini came to power, how they were saying, told you so? Mussolini is going to conquer the entire world and rule it for 3.5 years. And then suddenly they shut up about it when Germany had to step in and rescue Mussolini and his Italian kingdom from being conquered and destroyed by the Greeks. In other words, if it's been taught you by your clergyman, the odds are 1,000,000 to 1 he's wrong. The other is not yet come, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. Now, this seventh head is in a class with the first six. It can't be a revival of the Roman Empire, because the Roman head of this thing is the one that had the deadly wound and yet was healed. Rome has had its day and gone. It was number six. It didn't, the angel didn't tell John, now head number six is killed off, and then we go on to head number seven. There isn't one of these heads that can fit in the picture in that way. Number six was the Roman Empire, and it was to be succeeded by another. And this seventh has to be of a like kind. Definitely no man can understand this book out of any mere human cleverness. With a great deal of prayer for guidance, you begin to make some headway. Any man who can say, I am the first one to stumble on the correct explanation of some of these things, is perhaps likely to be wrong. You could literally pack this room from wall to wall and floor to ceiling with the books that have been written by people who tried to explain the book of Revelation. Without exception, they are all wrong in at least part. Many of them wrong in their totality. Some of them have seen portions of it correctly, but they slip up somewhere. I did find one thing that I wasn't able to find in such of the books as I looked into. If I'd undertaken to read them all, why, you wouldn't have gotten this closing lecture on this thing at least 3 years into the future, because it would have taken me that long to read all these things if I made it a 12-hour-a-day, 7-day-a-week occupation. But there's a big empire, important, satanic in its nature, exactly on a par with the kind that went before it, that they've all overlooked. Remember hearing about a man named Napoleon Bonaparte? Napoleon was commissioned an officer in the French army in 1785. After the Communist Revolution of 1793, he continued in the service and rose rapidly because of his brilliant successes in battle. The incompetent Communist Revolutionary government got them, of course, into messes, exactly like the incompetent communist governments have gotten themselves into in our own day, only they didn't have a wealthy United States governed by traitors to bail them out of their troubles like the commies have had today. So they were reaching the point of collapse by their gross incompetence in governing France, and they were overthrown by a sudden revolution, the coup d'etat, in 1799, and a new government was set up to be headed by a ruler called a consul. They'd gone back to the name, at least, of the old Roman officer of consul. A consul was not just somebody who gets you out of jail if you're arrested in some foreign country, as he is today. A consul was an important officer under the Romans. So Napoleon was appointed the first consul. This was 1799. By 1802, they voted him the office of consul for life. And then in 1804, he decided to stop fiddling around with formalities that didn't mean anything, and had himself proclaimed Emperor of the French. Then the Pope decided to get into the act. The old Holy Roman Empire was fizzling out completely. Napoleon had already licked a number of the kingdoms that were part of the main strength of the Holy Roman Empire. So the Pope was going to crown Napoleon again and say, "You see, you got your empire from me. I conferred it and I can take it back." Napoleon wasn't having any. He walked up and seized the crown out of the Pope's hands and with his own hands placed it on his own head. He'd gotten there on his own steam and he was letting the world know it. So December 2nd, 1804, Napoleon crowned himself emperor. Then he set out to make good on a complete European empire. This was the tail end of 1804. He assumed the imperial crown. In 1805, he took over Italy and was proclaimed King of Italy. In 1805, likewise, he defeated Austria. And the following year, the King of Austria formally abandoned the title of Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. In 1806, he defeated Prussia. In 1807, he defeated Russia and made them cede some territory to him. In 1808, he defeated Sweden. Now, that left nobody in the field facing him except England. The only nations of the continent of Europe which had undertaken to oppose him were defeated and conquered. Only England maintained a hostile attitude. So he was now the master of the entire continent of Europe. So he began placing his various relatives on the throne over these various nations. The throne of Spain, of Holland, of Sweden, and so forth. In 1809, he annexed to his territory the Papal States. And when Pope Pius VII excommunicated him for this, Napoleon threw him into jail until the Pope signed a treaty recognizing the conquest of the Papal States and that they were part of Napoleon's territory thereafter. The Pope was reduced to a merely religious leadership without any political power. Russia, however, was getting tired of their situation and beginning to rebel, ready to make war. So in June 1812, Napoleon began his invasion of Russia. He started out with his grand army, the largest ever raised in Europe up to that time, 500,000 men, drawn from all the nations of Europe that he had conquered. And he marched into Russia. He captured Moscow in September, on the 14th of September. Now, the thing that enabled Napoleon to get his great successes in war, he actually took a leaf out of the book of the two greatest commanders before him, Alexander the Great and Hannibal. Instead of relying upon supplies sent from home, which never worked out, because as soon as their army was gone, it was out of sight, out of mind, and the politicians left behind at home would much rather embezzle all the local money than spend any of it on supplies to send out to the army. It was always a case of too little and too late. So these great leaders simply lived off the land they conquered. Remember now, they didn't have all the elaborate machinery to supply that we had. Their soldiers didn't need guns and ammunition. Their weapon was a sword. As long as you kept the man fed, that was all the ammunition he needed or could use. So they simply plundered the country they went through. They stole its wealth to take home, I mean, anything in the way of money they could find, which was entirely metallic money then, and in its way good anywhere, good for its bullion value. they stole that and took with them. But basically, the important thing was they stole enough food to keep themselves fed, and they were in business. So Napoleon early learned that when he was an officer under the communist government of France. They never sent him supplies enough to keep his army in the field, but he plundered the conquered territories for enough. The second thing was, he had his soldiers so enthusiastic over his leadership that they were willing to really put forth some effort. And they marched with terrific speed. The secret of success in battle is to get there before your enemy is ready to meet you. Hannibal had it. Alexander had it. Napoleon had it. His troops would make tremendous forced marches, up to as high as 40 miles in a day. Not riding modern mechanized stuff, that was on foot, every step of it. And several days before the enemy had their forces ready to meet them, why, here these generals came in with their army, and such few troops as were mustered to oppose them, they easily routed. So Napoleon, having demonstrated the success of this, figured, well, that's fine. I'll conquer Russia the same way. I'll live off the land. Now remember, here he was. He'd crossed all of Europe, and now he was proceeding deep into Russia. Any supplies from back home had hundreds of miles to go, and basically this wasn't his territory other than France. The French might perhaps be loyal enough to him to feel they had to support him. But why should the conquered people of Austria and Hungary and so on feel a particular need to help him remain in power? The easterly portion of that, even before you got to Russia, was already hostile territory for his supplies to move through. And then he went into Russia. Oh, he whipped the Russian armies every time he caught up with them. But as they retreated, they adopted the scorched earth policy. They destroyed everything in back of them. They destroyed any food supplies, burned the cities, and retreated, leaving him nothing but a desolation to go into. So he captured Moscow on September 14th. All but a tiny fraction of the population had already fled before he got there. And on the 15th, fires broke out all over the city. Far too many to be put out. And from the 15th to the 19th, Moscow was in flames. And the whole city was burnt down. So here he was. He'd expected to make Moscow his winter headquarters. His soldiers would sleep comfortably in warm, well-heated houses and feed very nicely on the food supplies of the Russians. And now here were no houses and no food and the terrible Russian winter coming on. Well, he had to turn back. He was stubborn. He hung on for a month. It was the middle of October before he started, October 19th, before he started his retreat. He'd gotten back into European territory when, early in December, he no longer tried to remain with his retreating army. He went on ahead to see what he could salvage at home in France. Out of the 500,000 men that he took into Russia, 4/5 of them, 400,000 were killed. The retreat finally brought back 100,000 starved and tattered scarecrows out of 500,000 men that he led there. Well, a loser has no friends, no allies, surely. The nations that he had conquered when he was winning wouldn't stay with him now. They joined with England to overthrow him. And his efforts when he got back to France to hold this off were unavailing. So on April 12th, 1814, Napoleon abdicated. they banished him to the little island of Elba, a mountainous little island off the coast of central Italy. And if he wanted to play at being king, they gave him the title of King of Elba. Much as you might appoint somebody emperor of Tijuana. And there he was. However, there was no one competent to take over in France in his absence, and he saw a chance, he thought, to get back. So, March 1st, 1815, he and a small party of his followers landed in France trying to take over again. And so far as army loyalty was concerned, the old magic was there. The troops that were sent out to save him, or to seize him and arrest him, they came up to where he was, and he stepped out in front of his party. He said, "If there's any one of you that wants to kill your emperor, here I am." And the troops greeted him with tremendous enthusiasm and added to his followers, and he started back trying to retake France. It didn't work. His whole attempt at a comeback lasted approximately 100 days, and in the campaign around Waterloo, he was defeated and crushed in the middle of June, 1815. So you remember what was said about that seventh head. The other is not yet come in John's day, and when he comes, he must continue a short space. Well, you remember we commented before on what a brief time Alexander the Great's empire lasted. Starting out as king of Macedonia in 336 B.C., his empire lasted until his death in 323 B.C., and that's 13 years. Napoleon's empire lasted only 10 years. So he fills this. Here it was, a tremendous empire. It ruled nearly all the civilized world of its day. Certainly the territories that were ruled in Europe by the preceding empires. The character of it was as wicked as the preceding empires, just plain brutal tyrannical force. And it endured but a short time. So, getting to our own day, all of the seven heads are now past. But remember, there was to be an eighth. The angel said, the beast himself is the eighth and is of the seventh. Of the seven, I mean, of the same character. So there must be another great empire. But remember this, the beast is bigger and mightier than all of his heads put together. Each of these seven world empires was ruled, after all, by the king of a single city or nation. Those are the heads. But the beast is something much greater than that. It's not going to be just ruled by the troops of a single nation. So it's not the revival of the Roman Empire for 3.5 years has been falsely taught. Now let's try to identify this beast. It had existed in the past, John was told. The beast was, but in John's day, it is not. What is there that corresponded to this now? Remember, world empire on a greater scale than any one of these heads. What about Satan's original total world empire? The thing that Adam was sent here to overthrow. That's your original beast. Remember the dragon, obviously Satan, because the Bible calls him dragon and serpent. The dragon gave the beast his power and authority. So the beast itself was Satan's total world rule. That had ceased to be, and the thing had broken up into individual world empires for a period of time. And in John's day, the first century of the Christian era, the sixth out of these seven world empires was in effect. There were to be only seven. Remember that when you saw the great red dragon, John's vision, it had seven heads and seven crowns. Seven world empires were all that Satan had any authority to give. Remember what Satan told Jesus when he was tempting him? He said, look at all these kingdoms of the world. If you will worship me, I will give you all these kingdoms because they are mine to give to whom I please. And you remember, Jesus didn't say that isn't true. He accepted that as a perfectly correct statement for the time when it was made. But he told Satan, get thee behind me. It is written, thou shalt not tempt the Lord thy God. Now, when you come to Daniel's vision, his fourth beast, that was the Roman Empire, had only one head. It had 10 horns on that one head and 10 crowns, one crown for each horn. Now when you get to John's vision in the book of Revelation, there were 7 heads and 10 horns, and it doesn't say that they were all on one head. But since this thing ties in so closely with Daniel's vision, undoubtedly these 10 horns were part of the Roman Empire, so they were relatively minor. The crowns that Daniel saw were not as important as the crowns that John saw in the book of Revelation. Well, the beast bigger than any of these previous empires and of the same character as the 7 heads. It had existed before John's time, before the 7 heads started. It was not in power during John's time. It was to return to power as a universal world empire, not just the little nations clustered around the Mediterranean Sea. The United Nations is the only thing in all history that will begin to fit it, and the United Nations fits it perfectly. Tyrannical, brutal, and satanic as any of these others. Remember that in your United Nations headquarters in New York, the only concession they make to recognizing the existence of any god is a stone idol of the pagan god Zeus standing in the lobby. The name of Jesus Christ cannot be mentioned in any of its sessions for fear of offending the various pagan nations or the Jews who run the whole show. Definitely satanic, utterly tyrannical wherever it's gotten any power, and brutal in enforcing it. Now in the 13th chapter of Revelation, you have something else here. He says, and I beheld another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had 2 horns like a lamb, and he spoke as a dragon, and he exercises all the power of the first beast before him, and causes the earth and them which dwell therein to worship the first beast whose deadly wound was healed. And he does great wonders, so that he makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men, and deceives them that dwell on the earth by the means of those miracles which he had power to do in the sight of the beast. Well, undoubtedly, the papacy is at least a phase of this, because fake miracles have been the papacy stock in trade. You know how many churches they have where one of their stone idols of the Virgin Mary weeps from time to time, and others where they have the blood of St. Husus, which liquefies on certain days of the year, and all this sort of thing. It had 2 horns like a lamb, and it claims to be the successor to Jesus Christ. It speaks as a dragon, and certainly It has introduced so many satanic doctrines, and it has ruled with satanic corruption and evil through the centuries. So the papacy fits as a portion of this picture. But this thing is so big.